Hello and welcome to Boomeranging, from expat to repat, a podcast that explores the question, what could be so hard about returning home after years living overseas? I'm your host, Margot Anderson, and in each episode, I will sit down with a former Aussie expat to discuss how they survived repatriation and reverse culture shock, how they navigated the logistics of careers, friends, and family to successfully find their new place at home, and all without losing their global spirit. If you have just returned home, are thinking about it, or just love a good yarn told by professional globetrotters, then I have no doubt you'll enjoy meeting this diverse group of Australians. When Chelsea Guy came back from Tokyo and the work experience of a lifetime, she found she still had a paycheck, but she didn't have a role. Chelsea had worked her way through various marketing roles at Toyota when there was an opportunity to put her hand up for a coveted secondment. Her assignment? Digital marketing to support Toyota's sponsorship of the Tokyo Olympics. For Chelsea, not even being struck by the COVID curse could diminish the experience she gained working with an international team on the world's biggest event while learning a new skill in digital. However, when she returned to Melbourne 2 years later, she found she and her new experience didn't quite fit, even in the office she had worked for many years. Her Japanese experience unleashed her passion for major international events, and 18 months after returning home, Chelsea strategically forged a path to secure a coveted role at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Chelsea has managed to carve out a career that harnesses her global sponsorship experience, elevates her international connections, and supports her passion for delivering world-class events. Today I talk to Chelsea about how her international experience not only lit her career flame, but how she has combined all her experiences to create a pathway to her dream role. So welcome, Chelsea.
Thanks, Margot. Nice to be here with you.
Yeah, wonderful to have you. You're obviously in Melbourne if you're working for the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Yes, back in Melbourne now, and I'm at home in Yarraville.
Before we dive into your life in Japan, can you give us a snapshot of what life looked like before you headed offshore?
I left start of 2019, January, and the year prior to that, I had just moved back to Melbourne from about 5 years interstate in Adelaide, which is where I'd started with the company. I hadn't quite settled back into the groove of Melbourne, so it was an easy time as any to then just pick up and leave again.
And so the opportunity for an international assignment presented itself. I mean, how did that come on the radar? And was that actively something that you pursued and put your hand up? I mean, Toyota's a global company. You know, there's obviously things that are in the mix that you can explore.
Yeah, the expat program, intra-company transfer, ICT. So that's been around a long time. And with a company like Toyota, it can exist in several countries, but most of those assignments are in Japan to head office. It's not so well known within the company. I definitely didn't know about it for a while. But when I first heard about it was about 2016, 2017. I'd been there for, 4-5 years. And one of my friends and colleagues who was based in the Adelaide office with me, he went on an assignment directly from Adelaide to Nagoya. And that was a bit rare that he went from a state office to Japan rather than from head office. And he loved the experience. He kept in touch a lot and he recommended it a lot to me specifically. He knew I was going back to Melbourne. He said, Charles, you've got to get over there, like try and get over there with marketing. It's like the best thing that'll ever happen to your life. It's so amazing. So kind of off the back of that, I put up my hand. I was in conversations at that time to move from the Adelaide State Office back to Melbourne. And at that time I said, hey, I'd be interested in doing the Japan thing if it comes up. So I kind of just flagged it at that time. And then once I was back in Melbourne, it kind of resurfaced and went through a bit of a process. Yeah.
I mean, obviously the seeds were planted to go with Toyota. Do you think you would have gone just off your own bat? Maybe not to Japan, but would you have embarked upon an international life or career? Or do you think that it was really the impact of having seen somebody go with the company that unlocked the idea?
Yeah, I think for me, it had never occurred to me before. Look, the only kind of reference I had for a life overseas was when people did the young backpacker thing, and that had like zero interest for me. So I think when it came up that it was with the company, it was, you know, more established. Definitely that's more me. And because I'd been with the company for a while, I, you know, was planning to stay there a while. It just hadn't occurred to me to do it any other way.
Yeah, you grabbed it with both hands when you saw that it was an opportunity to take.
Yeah, and I guess the other part of it was I went maybe 2 years before I kind of heard about this ICT, and that was a running event in Japan that's essentially a long-distance relay with your teammates from your country competing against other Toyota countries or other departments within Japan. And so I was in Adelaide at this time and saw this announcement and thought, hey, I can run. I wonder if I'm fast enough to make the team. So it was top 10 females, top 10 males. And so I made that team and went over on this trip to Japan, and which had a bit of a kind of cultural flavor to it. We saw, you know, the Toyota Museum manufacturing plant, and it was so amazing. And the response I got from just people, like shop owners, whoever we met in Japan, when you said you worked for Toyota, it was mind-blowing. It was like they kind of worshipped the company. So it was just a very like wow first impression of Japan and my company in Japan. So I'd already had that experience, and then that probably helped a little bit towards the, oh, maybe I could come back.
Can you share a little bit about the role that you actually went for?
Yeah, so it's in the global marketing team for the Tokyo Olympics. We had a global campaign called Start Your Impossible, and we had a global team based in Tokyo, as well as another global team based in the US, and we worked together on this global campaign. And my role specifically was in digital marketing, which was predominantly a global website that supported that campaign, which was held in 7 languages. And that had a mixture of kind of TVC content for the games, a lot of like inspiring athlete content who were Toyota sponsored Olympic and Paralympic athletes, as well as information and content on the mobility products that would be at the Olympics. So a lot of the autonomous driving and kind of robotics type thing. A little bit of social stuff as well, which was more in the kind of athlete realm. It was a collaboration with the IOC and doing some social content series leading up to the games. So yeah, working with athletes again in the US again.
Amazing, amazing. I mean, that was 2019, you know, it was the Olympics that were disrupted. How did you have to adapt a role and I guess the work environment in Tokyo or at Toyota? Because, you know, COVID, you know, as we all know, changed everything, you know, it had such a massive impact.
Yeah, it was a bit of a bittersweet time. I remember very clearly that, you know, Feb, March leading up to the Olympics, and then when everything with COVID hit, we were coming up to like our biggest launch milestone for the Olympics, which was in April. It was the 100-day to go mark. So everything was about that. We were ready to hit go. And at the same time, we were having to make these backup plans. So what are we going to do if it's postponed or if it doesn't happen? Pretty high stress those kind of few months. And then when that announcement finally came, I remember I was in the gym and I remember seeing an alert come up. I was honestly very relieved because it was just such an unknown and intense period. And it was such a slow response to get to that. We knew that would happen. But so a bit of relief that now we could change gears and focus on, well, what are we going to do now? And we could just park the what was planned. But I guess what followed with that was just, you know, a much smaller project, smaller campaign, smaller everything to do with the Olympics. So that was a little bit sad, but from a work perspective, very big change in work environment for such a traditional company in Japan, where it's bottoms up, it's what's important. We actually were paid based on your swipe time in and out of the building based in 15-minute increments. So you got overtime. And it was purely from physically being there. So that change was very interesting to see that shift. And it just moved to like an email in, out, check in with your manager every day. And then he would pass that on to HR or finance. It was just bizarre. A huge culture shock over there.
Well, remote working was, you know, for many places was a shock. You know, at the best of times, let alone overlay a very traditional company and in a very traditional culture, the disruption there is just mind-blowing. Yeah. I guess, I mean, that's a big thing, right? Like Japan is just such a vastly different working culture, you know, the language factor, so big to prepare for. How did the organisation support you with the transition and going over there?
Yeah, there were a few things in the lead up. The big one being language. About 4 months out is the time that things are like properly confirmed, which is not that far out for a new language and culture. And so at that point, they kind of pulled the trigger on language classes. So there was 80 hours of scheduled Japanese studies that I could do. So I started those. Honestly, it was tricky to fit into the day. It would have been helpful if some work responsibilities were kind of eased to allow for just really beefing that up as much as possible. But I did the best I could, and I think I got to about 30 hours. We were really studying for the kind of language proficiency test. So there's five levels. N5 is the bottom, and I was really aiming to pass that test. So it was a lot of reading, writing, kind of grammatical stuff from kind of textbooks, and I definitely... my weakness was the speaking and listening part. It's quite funny when I got there, and the whole reason for this was because when you arrive, you go to induction, which is in the manufacturing plant in, you know, the middle of the country. You do a 2-day induction, and part of that is they sit you down for this placement test. And, you know, I really wanted to pass, didn't want to look bad on Australia. But I got there and they'd stopped doing the test maybe the year before. So... I guess I still did some good basics of language, but the goal shifted without my knowing. And so then I wasn't very prepared for the daily, you know, conversational life stuff. And that took a while for that to improve once I was there.
How did you enjoy the change in lifestyle? I mean, language is one thing, but it is a really different lifestyle as well. You know, what did you love about life in Japan?
Yeah, honestly, I loved it. It's just so busy. So from a lifestyle, personal life, it was just incredible. There's always something to do. I think people in that big city mindset, they're just kind of always up for doing something as well. So once you've kind of got your friendship groups, doesn't matter if it's a Tuesday night or a whatever night, people will be like, yeah, let's get dinner and drinks after work. And, you know, everyone is getting by in public transport. The trains are amazing. Very social time.
So you've had an amazing 2 years there, a time frame that you were given from the outset. How did you feel about the prospect of returning home when your time was drawing to a close? And especially because you actually didn't get to go to the Olympics, right? Because of the way that it pushed out, you didn't actually see the end result.
Yeah, that was the sad part. I kind of came to terms with that within a couple of months after the announcement. And then, yeah, throughout 2020, I was due to come home December anyway. The Olympics would have finished in September. There would have been a couple months wrap up and then I would have come home. So in the end, I didn't come home any earlier or any different timing. I just didn't get those through. But I think it's just a bit of a weird vibe when you're there for a set time. The first year is amazing. You're just living life and want to do everything. But as soon as it hits that second year, definitely that 18 months and you know you're due to come back in 6 months, you're kind of in a limbo, or you're trying to just pack in as much as you can before you leave. But you know there's an end timing, so it's kind of fine to come home.
Yeah, so you know, psychologically you're in that preparation mode of coming home. I'm interested to know then if and how repatriation was tabled with you. I mean, you know, on some levels, 2 years is not an enormously long time, but it's enough to really, I guess, blow up your perspectives and, you know, your worldview and what opportunities you could pursue from here. How were the conversations tabled? What discussions did you have?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Before I went, it was very much like, we don't know what role you'll come back to. It'll depend on business requirements. So it's a bit of a leap of faith. But the reasoning that you go on an assignment is your career development, and people who are selected are ready for promotion. So I guess it was expected I'd come back to a step up. Kind of an unwritten rule, I guess. While I was there, I was very keen to have those conversations earlier. So within my first year, I was tabling it, like, what's my return look like? What's this kind of career plan, career progression? The feedback I got at that time was, it's just too early. There's going to be at least two restructures before you come home, so we can't even look at it yet. And that is like a big annual restructure every January, and then a smaller one mid-year is generally how people move around the company. So they were the kind of earlier combos until it was kind of time to come home.
So when did it become apparent that there wasn't really a role for you to return to? And how did you manage this time? Because this was also in COVID.
Yeah. It was very close to my departure, unfortunately. So I'd had combos in the months prior about where I wanted to go. So I thought things were kind of in progress just behind the scenes. But it was actually very stressful on my last day in Japan, wrapping up. I'd returned all of my tech and I got like an urgent request for a meeting with a new manager plus a one-up. And at that time, it became clear there was no plan. And I was starting this conversation again on the day I was leaving Japan.
So it wasn't a redundancy per se. I know that in some of our other episodes with former guests, they were literally walked back in, got off the plane, and it was a redundancy. It was never that path. It was a path of, look, we're not sure what this looks like.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? You get off the plane, you go back into the office, or you dial into the office, you know, locally here. What do you do?
When I came back, we, of course, had the lovely hotel quarantine for a couple of weeks. So I just did lots of admin wrap-up of my time overseas during that period. And then there were conversations about what's happening role-wise. I guess at that time, you know, I found out there are a few policy changes which changed how I would come back. And when the kind of roles tabled to me were of no interest and just didn't make sense from a career point of view of what I'd been doing the last 2 years, we kind of came to an agreement of a temporary kind of holding pattern, helping out the current team, which is in sponsorships, while they sorted out a role for me in the digital team, which is where I wanted to go to flow on what I've done overseas. So what that looked like, it was just kind of, I don't know,
patched together.
Yeah, not in the most rewarding time.
Yeah. And look, I hear, you know, people saying to me, look, Margo, I was literally directed to the internet.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Yeah.
You did eventually find the role within the digital team. But during this time, you also realised that working on the Olympics had sparked this real passion, I guess, for international events and marketing of those events. How did you strategically, I guess, plan to make a shift into this area?
I had, a bit of downtime when I first came back. So I guess it started with a lot of research of what else was out there, because I knew the international events. I mean, now it's very lined up for the next 10 years. We've got the green and gold decade. So it's amazing. I'm very excited. But when I first came back, that wasn't announced. Yeah, I was just doing a lot of research, what was out there. I knew I didn't want to do the AFL and the cricket, which were the biggest opportunities here. So I really was focusing on localising my global experience. And when I'd gone into that role, digital was something new to me. So making sure I could ground that in Australia so then I'd be set up to go for that next role. So I really did a lot of upskilling in that kind of first year back. Then we... 21. So we're in the COVID year again. We were going in and out of lockdowns. But the Olympics still happened that year. Tokyo finally happened. And I was very happy. Like, I did not mind that I was in lockdown because I could watch Olympics all day.
Yeah.
All night. So I was so happy. And I finally saw all of our work come to life. I saw our TVCs come out. I saw just everything. So that was like a very special time. And it was also a time where I started reaching out to all of my friends and colleagues who worked on that project from different parts of the world. So it was a very connected time for me. And I definitely did what I could in my role with the company to still work on the Olympics from here, as well as kind of give a hand where I could, which was things like helping out with approvals that were kind of held up at IOC because I knew someone there. So I gave them a nudge and got something across the line that needed approval. So I did what I could to still have something to do at the Olympics here. And then the announcement for Brisbane came. Suddenly all became clear and all unfolded of where my next, you know, decade was going to head towards.
Yeah, so you've really gone, okay, it's sport. It's, oh, you know, that's what your initial path was initially. And then it did actually change tack slightly because you've ended up in the world of comedy. So I guess, you know, one of the nice things about having that time back, as you said earlier, is that you've actually bedded down some of your newfound digital skills. Can you share with us what you're actually doing today and I guess how you've leveraged that skill set?
So now I'm the partnerships manager at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which is coming up very soon. So I work with a number of partners across kind of corporate. There's hospitality, food and beverage partners. We have about 20 partners, like official partners, and then we've got another like 20 or 30, which are restaurants and bars around the city, which are part of the festival as well. So I am talking to a lot of different people in different businesses, which has been really great for me since I came from the one industry for such a long time. So it's been a real kind of eye-opener learning for me of kind of what's out there. And so we do all sorts of things. There's a lot of digital activity through those partnerships, as well as we'll do like event activations, a lot of, you know, corporate hospitality, ticketing, all of those things that come along with a major event. Yeah. And so I've been there since November. It's a year-round role and business, just coming into the crux of it right now.
Yeah, not long now at all. I guess by the very name, Melbourne International Comedy Festival, it suggests it's global. And I think it's the second largest international comedy festival in the world, if I'm correct.
It's it might be the third. It's in the big three, which is Montreal, Just for Laughs, Edinburgh Fringe, which is comedy plus all of the arts, and then us. Yeah.
And reputationally, it's held in really obviously high regard overseas. I mean, you are attracting comedians from all over the world. So you're keeping that international flavour and engagement alive there. How have you adapted the skills you learned from working in Tokyo to your new role at the festival? Because, you know, as you said, they're two completely different industries.
Yes, very different industries and organisations. I think what really helped me, honestly, was my return to Australia, the role that I waited for a while but got that digital role, because that was a really good in-between stepping point to where I am now, that it was a partnerships role with the company that delved into sporting sponsorship properties as well as some entertainment properties. And I had a lot of autonomy in how I crafted that. It was a customer loyalty program, using partnerships and delivering digitally a lot through CRM and website. So that was a really good return for me. And that allowed me to step into this role quite easily, that I had a lot of experience delivering these things from a corporate perspective, that then I could be on the other foot to, you know, try bringing new business or deliver these to other corporates.
What were the transferable skills that you were able to really leverage?
The big ones were budgeting, cost efficiency stuff, particularly through COVID on the Olympics. So, you know, we had a budget, but then we had to, you know, be really smart with it to get through that extra year. Also, there's some pretty stringent approval processes in Japan to get things over the line. So the budgeting, the attention to detail on, you know, typos, just everything kind of formatting wise was very, very important. So those two were really big, and they're important now because we are trying to get new business. So we're doing proposals out to companies. So the definitely attention to detail, very important. As well as, I guess the environment is so different, and I've never worked in a festival world before. But it's very transient. People are coming in and out all of the time. There's some core staff, but then there's, you know, every day, every week, there's more contractors coming on. So there's a lot of people involved. A lot of things are happening on the fly. It's very different.
That scale up quickly, scale down, you know, like meeting the demands or the rhythms, you know, that go with something like, you know, the event cycle.
For me now, I have like a curiosity that probably came from Japan and just being in this environment where your kind of mind's exploding every day and just trying to figure out what's going on. And now I'm like seeing these new people come in, the festival's ramping up, and I just want to know more, more, more. And there are so many artists involved. There's over 650 comedians that will perform from a whole lot of countries. You know, I have a lot of knowledge from Auto, which I, you know, have definitely used this year in trying to find a new partner. So successfully brought on Kinto as a new partner the festival this year, and they are actually a sub-brand of Toyota. So, yeah, brought them on. So they are like a car rental brand of Toyota. So I guess I had a lot of the knowledge of how that business works and how a festival like this would be, a benefit to. And it's newish company. It's only a few years old, so it's still growing.
I always find it really interesting too that often it's not the skills that get you the job, but they're the skills that help you do the job and be so efficient and so impactful at what you do. And part of that is then about how do we package that up, right? And how do we use that going forward, you know, in the next role, et cetera. So I think that actually the efficiencies at which we operate are just so much quicker.
Definitely, yeah.
Now, one of the things I know just from our engagement is that, you know, you've been really heavily invested in expanding your local professional network. When you made the decision to sort of look at international events, you really went hard at growing out your sports and entertainment networks. How have you approached this, and what types of activities have been, I guess, most beneficial?
It honestly started, I would say, with the Comedy Festival last year. So I knew I wanted to be involved in more of these events. I was very aware I'd been in corporate for a long time, and I'd done a lot of corporate events and activating, you know, big sponsorships, but they're very corporate. So I really wanted to balance that out with a bit more kind of consumer-facing event experience. And so I got myself into a casual role with the Comedy Festival last year, doing front of house, you know, scanning tickets, sending people into seats. And that was kind of through a contact that got me in there. And it was the most incredible experience. I just did it weekends, like on top of my day job. So much fun. It was definitely an insight into just operationally how kind of things worked. And then I found from there, now that I could add that to my CV, it just started opening up more of these sort of opportunities. So the next one I targeted was the FIFA Women's World Cup last year, which was an incredible event. I applied to volunteer there. So I did a volunteer opportunity there, which was great. Met so many people. And kind of from there, it's just snowballed, because the second you meet someone, you're like, where have you worked? Where are you going? And people are just so happy to introduce you, or, oh, talk to this person. Oh, this is how you get those jobs. This is the timing. So just a lot of that info that I just had no idea about just started becoming pretty free-flowing.
And actually, the diversity of people that are volunteering, ages, you know, backgrounds, industries, like it's such a melting pot of rich experience. And, you know, everybody, as you said, is really happy to open doors, right? So once I feel like once you put yourself out there, life, you know, rewards you with these really interesting people who are generous.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, there were, you know, it ranged from uni students through to, you know, someone on a gap year to retirees. It's been really great. And kind of from there, I was trying to figure out how to work at the Oz Open. I wanted to for years. So I got into a casual role there. So been doing a few of these things on the side, and they're just helping build up that kind of major event side. And, you know, hopefully I won't have to volunteer for too much longer.
Yeah. And that's the importance then of getting your story right, your positioning right, because you are meeting these incredible people who want to help you. If you can clearly articulate what you're looking for, I think that just, you know, narrows it and streamlines it. And, you know, as I think I've always said, you know, people want to help, you know, they just don't know how, you know. So if we can make that easy, they'll open their little black books.
Yeah. And I've definitely met a few people along the way who have been helping me, and they're, you know, they're curious and they want to kind of give back, and that's been so rewarding. So, you know, I've got a few more senior people that I can kind of touch base with and kind of lean on direction.
What would be your advice to others navigating a return to Australia with their company? So, you know, if you think back, you know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, you know, what are your learnings? What are your insights?
Mine would be to start those conversations early. In my experience, I was there for 2 years. The first year I was told that's too early, but I think at that 1 year mark, I should have started like official conversations. What does my return in 1 year look like from now? The other part is visibility within the company, which I was definitely advised on early on. So I did kind of monthly emails back to the division on this is what my life looks like in Japan, full of photos, as well as like summaries of what I was doing on the Olympic project. So that was good, but I stopped that in 2020 because I felt it was a bit not quite right to be showing that I was still allowed to travel in Japan when Melbourne was in a lockdown.
Yes. Yeah, the sensitivity around that
work. Yeah. So I was very removed from the company in 2020. And I guess the other thing is management move around a lot. So I was reporting in very specifically to my lineup on what was happening. But by the time I moved back, they'd all kind of moved on. So I think I would have been better to report to like the broad management group.
Really incredible points, you know, a year out, remaining visible and remaining connected, you know, connected to your key influences from within, right? It's and that takes a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. The other one, and I gave this feedback to global mobility team, was like the technical connectivity. And this was just like by bad luck. I kind of followed the process to the T before I left, and that meant I had to return my phone. And then, you know, systems changed and I couldn't contact Australia anymore via Skype or Teams. So I was completely cut off. And then by the time I raised it and got a phone back, my number had already been passed on to someone else. So it just meant that I'd lost like 7 years of business contacts.
Wow. Yeah, that's big.
Yeah, and it's just hard to get those back.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's a really powerful insight. What are your thoughts about another international assignment? Would you go again?
My views on this have changed dramatically in the last year. It was a really tough return, and it wasn't just work, it was everything coming back in that kind of COVID time. So it took me almost 2 years, so as long as my overseas assignment, to fit back into life back here comfortably. So the thought of leaving again seemed like quite horrifying. But now that it's all good again, it's definitely creeping up on my mind. And I definitely have my eye on what major international events are coming up, because there's a lot. But I think I might more so do like a shorter stint. But I definitely want to tick off some major events before, you know, the Olympics here starts ramping up.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, it's, you know, it's all there to play for, right? And I guess lived experience is learned experience. And so it's about how do we take those learnings and I guess wrap them up to next time, because we have a lot of double, triple boomerangers in our community, right? And they do talk about, you know, the learnings that they take. But more and more we are seeing shorter term opportunities coming up. You know, once upon a time it was, you know, off you go and we'll see you sail into the sunset and come back when you're ready. But, you know, we are seeing those more almost secondments that are, you know, got the time box around them. So, yeah. Now, as you know, we close all of our podcast episodes with 5 quick questions. So I'd love to put those to you now. Living overseas taught me what about myself?
I can do anything. Yeah. I mean, being able to survive in a different language, culture, and just the so many cultural nuances and unwritten rules. Yeah. It just gave me confidence in what I can do.
The number one skill I use today in my business is?
Softer communication style. It was definitely the thing I struggled with the most. So put aside to one fact, there's a language barrier. Even when things are happening in English, I would be in a meeting listening to the same conversation and I would take away a completely different understanding. I'm very much a direct communicator and the Japanese are very indirect, so full of what's not said and what's not spoken. So I really struggled with that in Japan, and coming back here, well, it's a lot clearer now if things are unspoken and it's in English and we're from the same culture. But just, yeah, having a bit of a softer approach too. My communication is something that has improved from when I first left.
The best thing I've discovered since arriving home is?
how great Melbourne is. So a friend of mine who was on assignment with me, she went home 6 months before me to Paris, and she had some great advice, which I followed, which was to treat your home city like you're on an expat assignment, like you're a tourist. Be a tourist in your own city. So I've like loved Melbourne so much in the last couple of years. Like I'd lived here for years before, kind of been in and out of Melbourne over the years, but I'd never really felt like I was a woman. That's due to the fact I didn't grow up here and it's just such a big city, and I'd kind of remained in one pocket in the southeast. But when I came back, I'd lived in two different parts in Flemington and now Yarraville, and just explored a lot more of Melbourne that I'd never seen before. And that's been amazing.
The first thing I'd encourage a new repat to do is?
I'd say if circumstances allow, would be to move to a different part of the city.
Ah, nice.
Explore it with fresh eyes. Like if you're not tied down with a mortgage that you've left before moving overseas, that has been incredible for me, experiencing new local communities.
A word, song or phrase that sums up your life in Japan?
This is a very niche one. It's actually an anime. It's made by Sanrio, so the creators of Hello Kitty. So it's kind of big, but even in Japan, my friends and colleagues were like, how did you hear about this and why do you like it? It's called Agretsuko, which means like aggressive. And Retsuko is like an animal character of the show. But essentially, it follows the life of like a 25-year-old graduate in an accounting firm. So it's life in a very traditional Japanese company, and all of the things that might happen there. And each character is like a different animal. And I found it hilarious because it really just summed up what my day-to-day work life was like. And I just couldn't believe it. Just like some of the mind-boggling things I couldn't wrap my head around. And just like a very comedic kind of social commentary.
Yeah, beautiful. So you tune into that regularly now?
Yeah, it's on Netflix now, actually. Yeah.
Oh, is it? Oh, there you go. Now, I do have a bonus question. I can't let you go without asking you about this season's International Comedy Festival. Who are your top suggestions to go and see for those who are in Melbourne? Or to keep an eye out if they're travelling?
Yeah. So I'll start with my all-time favourite, a good Aussie stand-up, Dave Thornton. He is fantastic. I've been seeing him for many years. Like whether I was in Melbourne or Adelaide, I always see his shows. He is great. A really great UK stand-up is Carl Donnelly. Saw him for the first time last year. He's fantastic. Really, really great. There is a lineup show called Comedy Zone Asia. It's a one-night show this year, and there's at least five or six artists within that. And it is a great lineup. I've seen a few of them in last year's festival. For some like really silly musical comedy, There's a New Zealand married duo called Two Hearts, and they're really, really fun, high energy. And then I guess the other thing that's worth keeping an eye out for is there's a late night kind of comedy after party venue. It's at Matt's Watts opposite Town Hall, and the night is called the Festival Club. And it's late night, so if you go to some other show, then you can head here afterwards. It kicks off at like 11 p.m. It'd be like an hour show, and there's just all sorts of different events on over the festival, like lip sync battles, like improv, all sorts of. So you'll see like so many artists within that then you'll be like, oh my God, I love them. I want to go see them.
Look, Chelsea, I've thoroughly enjoyed our chat. I appreciate you sharing your insights, and best wishes for, you know, life in the comedy sporting arena.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review, share it with your friends and family, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on our guests, please head to our website, insyncnetworkgroup.com, where you can check out the show notes and also find more information about our career advisory programs and fabulous community.